the most fascinating books I've read recently is by Laurie Oakes, and it's called Hidden Oaks. The book tells the story of Des and Jenny. Des and Jenny were missionaries in Papua New Guinea, and they wanted to bring the gospel, just like Ross, to Papua New Guinea. They wanted to bring the gospel to a small tribal group, one of the smallest. And the group only had 111 people. And they wanted to tell these group of people that God loves people. Even if it's only 111 people, God loves them. So Des and Jenny went as a team, and they were met with very much cold shoulders. They told the gospel to this group of people, but they brushed it aside and they thought it was white man's religion. They saw Jesus as nothing more than the white man's spirit. So Des and Jenny had a big vision. Just like Ross, they wanted to translate the New Testament to this tribal group. So each day they work hard learning the languages. Each day they try to translate the New Testament, but they never got very far. After a number of years, they only managed to translate Matthew chapter 1, which is the genealogy of Jesus all the way from Adam. So one day, Des and Jenny heard back from their sponsors that they are no longer sponsoring their program, because the people they're working with were too small. And after all these years, their ministry was bearing no fruit. They had zero converts, and their vision of translating the Bible was not successful. They only managed just one out of 260 chapters in the New Testament. So their sponsor said, "Enough is enough. We are not throwing money back into a cause that is sinking. Pack up your bags and come home. We won't be supporting you anymore." So reluctantly, Des and Jenny did that. They wrapped up their work, packed up their bags, and were about ready to say goodbye. The final night, they got to say goodbye to the tribal chiefs. And then they said to the tribal chiefs, "We have one last gift to give to you before we leave. And that is, our goal is to translate the New Testament. And we want to read to you the New Testament. But we've only translated one chapter of the New Testament. And that's Matthew chapter 1. So for all it's worth, since we're leaving tomorrow, we'll just read to you Matthew chapter 1 in your language." And the chieftains all said, "Of course you can do that." So Des took up his Matthew translation and started reading. He thought, "Wow, who is going to warm up to a genealogy? All names. This is just a pure waste of time." But for good gesture, he read. After Matthew 1 was read, there was silence. Tears were streaming down the faces of the tribal chiefs. And one of them said to Des, "Why didn't you read this to us earlier? You see, Jesus is one of us. He's not just a white man's spirit. He's one of us. He has ancestors, just like we have ancestors. That's what the genealogies are about. It shows us that Jesus has ancestors. He's human being. He's like us, coming to save us, not like a spirit that's not real." To many of us, genealogies are boring. But not too many people in the world, because genealogies speak of real people, real problems, and real need. When I was a teenager, I always thought to myself, you know, if I were God, I would do a better job writing the Bible than our present Bible. For starters, I'll get rid of all the genealogies. I would get rid of all the unpronounceable names. I would take out all the historical details. Who cares who Assyrians are? Who cares who the Romans are? Who cares about all these things? And I will turn the Bible into a manual. Chapter 1 will begin with 10 irrefutable proofs that God exists, and nobody can ever argue with that. And then chapter 2 will be 10 irrefutable proofs that Jesus is God. Then I'll go one chapter after that, addressing different needs. One chapter on suffering, one chapter on the end times, so nobody can fight about these things, and make it crystal clear. But manuals don't change people, do they? How many of us buy a TV and read the manual every night and put it by our bedside? Not many of us, at least not me. I never touched these manuals. Rather, the Bible is about a personal God who cares about us and cares about individuals. And that's what the genealogies are for, as we looked at the First Chronicles. So we are studying through, if you've just joined us, our church, we are studying through 1 and 2 Chronicles. We'll see how far we get, but that's my initial goal, 1 and 2 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles chapter 1 verses 1 to 27, which is the passage we looked at last week, tells us that ever since Adam, there was something wrong with the world. Every name that is mentioned, 92 of them from the first 27 verses, all mentioned just names, and they were all barren names. Nothing was added. Nothing was described about each name. Each name just appeared by itself, save for Nimrod and Peleg. All the 92 names were just by themselves. Because the chronicler is trying to point out a very important problem that pervades history. Not just Israel, but the entire human race. And he's making the point that humanity has sinned. Regardless of how many wives these men have in this genealogy, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how many camels they own. It doesn't matter. Because in God's eyes, they're all barren. Because there is a problem. So 20 generations later after Adam, we come now to the 27th verse of the first chapter of 1 Chronicles. God here is about to save the world again, but he's not going to do it in an abstract form. He's going to do it through one human being and one family. And he's decided to do that through the family of one man and the 75-year-old Abram. So let's see what the chronicler has to say about Abram. 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 27. The chronicler is not a chatterbox. Doesn't tell us a lot, but he tells us the important things. What does he say about Abram? Verse 27. And Abram, that is Abraham. Just only a few words here, but it tells us a lot about Abram. The word Abram means exalted father, and Abraham means father of many. What is the chronicler trying to teach us here? How is God going to save the world? He's going to save the world through this man called Abram, who's the exalted father, and he's going to make him the father of many. Because through the descendants of Abram, the world will be changed. The world will meet the Christ that God will send. But how is God going to use Abram to save the world? He will make Abram wait. He will make Abram wait. Waiting is God's way of saving God, the world. You will see that immediately when we talk about verse 27, what would you expect to come next? God is going to save the world through Abram, who is going to be Abraham, who is going to be the father of the nations. We're expecting God to say the next sentence. How? Through his offspring, through Isaac, God is going to bring all these sons and who will be the true heirs of Israel and who will bring about the Messiah. But that's not the case. Verse 29 is actually a very difficult verse, because it says, these were the descendants, Nebooth, the son of Ishmael, Kedar, Abil, Mibasham, Mishma, Duma, Masa, Hadad, Tima, Jitu, Nafesh, and Kedama. You would expect the God to be talking about Abraham's descendants through Isaac, because we know from the book of Genesis that it's through Isaac God will save the world. But God says, wait. 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 Before Isaac comes, there will be Ishmael. And that's the story of the Old Testament, isn't it? About waiting. Because you would expect God to immediately provide the answer. But instead of providing the answer, God makes Abraham wait. It's not the sons of Ishmael, his firstborn, that God will save the world, but it will come 25 years after. Wait. Why? Number one, two lessons we can learn. Waiting breaks down our pride. Waiting breaks down our pride. If you read the book of Genesis, you will understand that Abraham was a very patient man. We always think of him as a very impatient man. But when God first made the promise to Abraham, he was already 75 years old, and Abraham didn't really act on it. He waited for God 11 years, didn't have a son. God told him that he would have a son, but he waited for 11 years. Imagine Abraham going to the market and seeing, let's say, his friend Obed, for instance, seeing him and saying, "Oh, God has promised you a son. One that will save the world. So Abraham, is your wife Sarah pregnant yet?" And Abraham says, "No, not yet." A year passed, and Abraham is in the market, and he meets his friend Obed again. He says, "God promised you a son. He's going to save the world. Is Sarah pregnant yet?" "No, not yet." Another year passed, and he meets Obed again. "God promised you a son. He's going to save the world. So is Sarah pregnant yet?" "No." 10 years. And still no news. Abraham here is 86 years old. And so Sarah said to Abraham finally, find yourself a concubine and let the concubine have a son with you. Maybe that's how God will fulfill his promise." And so Abraham took a concubine by the name of Hagar and gave birth to Ishmael. And we think Ishmael is the answer, that this is how God will bless the world. But is Ishmael the answer? Verse 29, these were the descendants, Naboth, the son of Ishmael, Kedar, Abel, Mitsam, Mishma, Duma, Masah, Hadad, Tima, Jetu, Nephish, Kedama. Is Ishmael the answer? Count the number of descendants mentioned there. 11 sons of Ishmael. In the book of Chronicles, numbers are very important to the chronicler. Usually God's number in the book of Chronicles is 12. And God here lists only 11 sons of Ishmael. What does God say? Yes, he may be your son, but he's not the answer. Why does God make us wait? Because God makes us wait to break down our pride. That's not by our own ingenuity. It's not by our own wisdom that God accomplishes his work. Abraham thought, "Oh, since I've waited 11 years, I now take things into my own hands. I can do it. Let's do it this way. This is the human way." But God often takes the time to break us down. It's not through human ways that God saves. I remember when I first came back from Canada after serving in the US and Canada for some time, I wanted to look for a church. I've told this a number of times, but it's worth talking about it again. I was looking for a church in Australia. While many jobs in the secular world is being advertised on websites and newspapers, church jobs, pastoral jobs usually are not advertised. So once I called a Presbyterian church and asked the leader, "Now, how do you find work as a Presbyterian pastor, for instance?" "Oh," he said, "you have to join a Presbyterian church for a year, and then you have to be a member for a year. The session of elders need to vote on you and recommend you. Then you have to undergo training." And then I said, "Oh, does that mean that I'll get the job after all these the processes?" He says, No. Just a candidate. Then you have to wait." And I thought, I don't really have time to wait, do I? And I was registering at Centrelink at this time. And Centrelink will tell you to work with one of the job search companies. And for them, waiting is never in their vocabulary, because every 2 weeks or a month, they will ask you and they will always ask you, "Are you looking for a job? What have you done? What have you been looking at?" And frankly, being a pastor is not something that they will help you find jobs. And with my background, with a PhD in preaching and the Old Testament, it's not very marketable, right, in the secular world. So I remember telling the person there at the job search, "I have a PhD in the Old Testament." She looked at me as if I was mad, and she just brushed it off. "Are you looking for work?" So what do you say? At that time, I was very discouraged, and I was still preaching from time to time, and I was invited to preach at the Central Coast. I was in Sydney at this time. I was driving to Central Coast to mainland to preach. And as I was driving, I cried out to God, "God, I think I'm giving this up. I don't think I want to be a pastor anymore. I should search for another avenue."